No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the discussion. You can call in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a very special guest tonight, but first, let me introduce my co-host, Maria Sanchez. We were off last week because of the Super Bowl. And unfortunately, my dear friend Maria's team didn't make it. You know, Maria was gushing about what a Rams fan she was on the last show. And we're sorry. It was, let me tell you. I had to ask people what the outcome of the game was because I fell asleep three times. You know, it was such a slow and boring game.
Well,
you know,
total defense.
Yeah, it must have. There must have been so much going on in the trenches that we couldn't see because to keep the score that low with two great teams. But you know, unfortunately, I don't know about other people, but I'm a Skins fan and we weren't even in the running. So, you know, it's okay to get silver and they'll be back next year, I'm sure. but the good news on our part is...
Did you do news? I was going to say lobbying, more signatures.
We did. We got five more people in the last... Since the last show, we got Veronica Escobar from Texas 16th District, Abigail Spanberger from Virginia 7th, Sean Kasten from Illinois 6th, Ann Kilpatrick from Arizona 2nd, and Elaine Luria from Virginia 2nd District. Five more members of the House. We're up to 195. Now, as you know, all we need is 218. And that's the majority of the House. The legislation would, at the very least, pass through the House, and we're hopeful for we're going to have a hearing. We've been guaranteed, or we've been told, we're going to have a hearing on the bill, and we might even get a floor vote, which we haven't had since. I mean, in fact, Mayor Pratt may have been, who's our guest tonight, may have been mayor. In the last time we had a floor vote, because it was in the early 1990s. And, you know, so we're excited about that. And
well, this is historic.
Yes, and we have a delegate from the state of Maryland that's putting in a resolution in the state assembly, a resolution in support of us. So things are rolling. And today I went out and gave a speech to about 10,000 people. It was great. At the Chinese New Year celebration here in Washington. It's the year of the pig, and the pig is a symbol of good luck and prosperity. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. This might be our year.
I happenstance. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hear you great.
Okay. To go to lunch at a Chinese restaurant, which I do maybe once a year, and it happened to be on Tuesday.
Oh, right.
And I had no idea until the waiter and everybody else was celebrating. It's like, it's Chinese New Year. That must be a good omen.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we had fun today. This is a big deal in Chinatown. We have a Chinatown section in Washington. It was a big deal. And I also thought about you yesterday, Maria, because I went to with my oldest friend, my friend Rick Railing, who I met at my 12th birthday party. And he and I have been riding motorcycles together for 40 years. And we went to the International Motorcycle Show, and I bought a raffle ticket to get a Street Glide. So everybody keep their fingers crossed.
Did you?
Yeah, we'll see.
You know, Maria, what, Michael, my last bike was a Street. Bike was a Street Glide, and it's a huge difference. It's a big bike. It's a scary bike.
I know, but you know what? Just to have it in my driveway. Because
you're used to your sporty.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
yeah.
Mrs. Brown.
And, and people kept saying to me, are you going to buy a motorcycle today? And I said, well, you know, first I have to get a divorce, and then I'll go. I can go out and look for a motorcycle. But without further delay, this woman has been so kind to us because she was on the show not too long ago, and she's agreed to come back. We have with us today the former mayor of the District of Columbia, Sharon Pratt. And before we bring her on, just let me tell you a little bit about her in case you're out there and you don't know. But in 1990, Sharon Pratt was elected mayor of Washington, D.C., the first African-American woman to hold such a position in the U.S. In 1995, she served as a visiting fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. From 97 to 2001, Mayor Pratt served as the president of the Center, a startup digital platform enabling B2B transactions with Africa. And I've got to ask her what a B2B transaction is. And in 2002, she began Pratt Consulting, working with companies, nonprofits, and governments. So we're so happy to have her back with us today. Mayor Pratt, are you there?
I am. Delighted to be with you and Maria.
Oh, it's so nice of you to be back.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor. Yes.
It really is. And I was, and just so you know, Mayor Pratt, I was at the Chinese New Year's thing today with our current Mayor Bowser and several members of the City Council. And of course, I bragged that you were going to be all senator regards to you. You are held such in our city. And I just want you to know that. And last week, I was privileged enough to go and listen to the mayor and several other people, including Michael Steele, who's involved in this new project. Michael Steele, as you might know, was the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland and the chairman of the Republican Committee. And they're involved in a new project, exciting project, at the University of District of Columbia, one of the oldest HBCUs in the country. And they've created a thing called the Institute for Politics, Policy, and History, or more affectionately known as the IPPH. That kind of rolls off your tongue. So Mayor, thanks for being with us to discuss this. The mayor is the founding director and is an advisory committee member. So tell us, Mayor, why is this so exciting? I know why I think it's
well,
so exciting.
It is exciting. I do want to say that before I get into the Institute, that 1993 vote was a result of a lot of work, a lot of energy, and we faithfully marched every Thursday for over a year on to push the issue of statehood. And a lot of people would join us, including folks like Dick Gregory, who's gone now, and Al Sharpton, and some Jesse Jackson would on as well. But faithfully, Al Sharpton and Dick Gregory. And it ultimately culminated in that first vote we had in 1993. So at least we got a vote in the House. The Senator Ted Kennedy was terrific in trying to help us on the Senate side. But at least we got a respectable vote And now we've just got to keep building on that momentum. And I very much appreciate your leadership, Michael. And the mayor is very much engaged around this whole notion and this commitment to achieving statehood. So I think we've got a lot of energy now. And I think there's a real possibility of our finally attaining our goal with a lot of good work. So all of this is actually relevant in some ways to what we have just recently launched. The mayor of the District of Columbia, the executive office of the mayor, and the University of District of Columbia, which as we know is the state university for the District of Columbia, the only public university in the District of Columbia, have launched an Institute of Politics, Policy, and History. So it's not unlike, in some ways, the Institute of Politics that I participated in at Harvard, and of course they have them at Georgetown, University of Chicago has one, Axelrod started one there, and it's, you know, in that sense it has a real focus on introducing practitioners of politics and public policy to a new generation so they have practical exposure to what it means to be an elected senator or mayor or what have you, or secretary of HUD, whatever it may happen to be. Ours is different in that we also have the added mission, very important to the mayor, of accessing, unearthing the history of our city from its inception. Because unlike almost any other place, we weren't even a city, a town, or anything. We were created out of whole cloth from Maryland and Virginia in order to create a capital for a brand new nation. You know, the Washington, D.C. has a very interesting history. And, of course, if you got assigned here, if you were from a foreign country and you had to go to Washington, D.C., that was tough duty because it was pretty much, a swampy kind of environment. No hotels, nothing. And so, but we've evolved into becoming one of the favorite destination spots in the world. And so what we want to do through this institute is to tell that story of our history. And we believe that that story of our history, you know, which tells the story of America, will help illuminate conversations about challenges of today. We'll talk about one of the first events will be around the historic number of women in the House of Representatives. And so that is the essence of who we are, the Institute of Politics, Policy, and History. And maybe if people understand better our important role in American history, they'll be a little bit more enthusiastic about allowing us to fully participate in political life of America.
Are you going to curate the history? How are you going to get it to be?
We are going to call upon a variety of folks, particularly, well, we have two ways we're going to do it. One, on a lot of when we have panels, we'll often call upon historians who can speak to that particular aspect, let's say, of American history through the lens of the nation's capital. The other of which is to call upon respected residents who can help us sort of curate, as you would say, a particular facet of the history of this city. So we have Aviva Kempner, who's a graduate of the University of District of Columbia Law School, who's a very celebrated film documentarian. She's going to do a piece on the history of Greek and Jewish theaters of Washington. Another, for example, Rolamin Kwanda, is someone who can trace his family's history back really beyond Mount Vernon, but who can tell the story of how his family from Mount Vernon as slaves to living today in Brookland, Washington. And so that's how we're going to do it. And also the District of Columbia government is planning to transfer the D.C. archive so that it will be reposed at the University of the District of Columbia. So we'll also have, it's great synergy in terms of celebrating our history and making that history more accessible to contemporary audiences.
Well, I got to tell you, Mayor, it's something that's always bothered me since I've had this office, because as you say, we have such a unique history and we have such an important history, especially when you talk about civil rights, everything from the March on Washington to Brown versus Board of Education to Roe versus Wade, to all these, to the Women's March. We've played such a central role. I've often wondered why people are not more interested in the history of the District of Columbia and in our unique situation, being the only capital in the world where we exclude the people that live in the capital from participation in the national legislature. It's always bothered me that I've always wondered, maybe that's a better way to put it, why people aren't more interested in this. So hopefully we'll get some.
Well, yes. Didn't mean to cut across you.
No,
well,
Senator,
okay. I mentioned Senator Ted Kennedy, who was a huge supporter of D.C. statehood and our efforts, he told me once, he said, you know, my brother, speaking of President John Kennedy, used to say the reason it exists is because it's a well-kept secret. People really don't know that the people who live in the Capitol, you know, in the bulwark of democracy, are denied their basic real rights to participate in our political system. He said it's a well-kept secret. And so our history is not a well-told history, I think. People have a vague sense of what the Founding Fathers did, and then they sort of know we were the home of Chuck Brown and, you know, Go-Go and all of that. It's not, I don't think they understand how nuanced the history is. For example, you talked about being in Chinatown today. You know, people really don't know much about our history in terms of the Chinatown and the Asian community of Washington. There's so many dimensions to our city. One reason when I was in office pushed, you know, the Taste of D.C. just to, you know, have an explosion of cuisines expressing the ethnic diversity of the city. And it's just so much of our history has not been well told, for whatever reasons. And so part of the purpose of the Institute is to call upon, as we said, respected residents who will begin to tell those stories. And with those stories and with their efforts, we will begin to create additional data points to be placed in the D.C. archives.
You know, having been the co-host with the senator for, I think it's about 2.5 years now, Michael, I'm shocked and stunned based upon what you just said, how most people don't know the disenfranchisement of the residents of the District of Columbia. And when somebody says to me, tell me about your radio program, and I say, well, I co-host with the senator from Washington, D.C., people don't look at me twice.
Yes.
Yeah.
They don't know about the shadow politics. No right. one. I think right. I would think one person maybe in these 2.5 years has said, wait, can't have a senator from the District of Columbia. And I was like, oh, you know your history. Everybody else just takes it.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I often tell the story about going to Ohio to speak and having the people at the venue that I was supposed to speak come up to me and say, Senator, the governor's here and we're just not sure who gets to go first. Do you get to go first as a United States senator, or does the governor get to go first? You know, and that happens to me a lot outside the District of Columbia,
right?
Not so much inside the District of Columbia. But let me ask you, Mayor, when you spoke the other day, and by the way, I told you this when I talked to you the other day on the phone that you're an amazing speaker. But when you spoke the other day, you mentioned that this was something that had been in the works for a very long time, and it had been out there, and it had been recently resurrected by you and the mayor and other people. Why did it take so long? Because it seems like such a great idea. Why do you think it took so long to get it together and make it happen?
You know, I'm not sure of that. For, as I said, many years ago when we first had Home Rule, then Councilmember Arrington Dixon did try to push the idea, and then ultimately when he became chairman, he was able to get marshal the votes to create an Institute for District Affairs with the support of Mayor Barry. And it existed at the University of the District of Columbia for 10 years. Strong focus was to sort of chronicle the history of home rule. And then, for whatever reason, it stopped getting funded. And that was entirely funded by the District of Columbia government. And many different, as now that this has been launched, any number of people have come forward to help who said they, too, had been trying to get this, make this happen. Why suddenly it happened, I'm not certain. A lot of it was clearly the mayor's interest and her enthusiasm around celebrating the history of our city, you know, having that component, and it's the full arc of history celebrated, and to make it accessible to, as I say, contemporary audiences.
I would think that funding must have something to do with it, right?
Oh, I think probably. It was probably because the District of Columbia government was to underwrite it for 10 years. So when we launched it this time, there was seed money. But by October, I've got to find other sources of funding, private dollars, and I'm certain we can, to find private dollars to keep it operating. And we're going to turn to the public to donate as well. And then hopefully foundation money to create an endowment so that through, private dollars, in particular foundation money, as well as the general public, we can have a self-sustaining, independent 501c3, but always lodged at the state university, at the University of the District of Columbia.
Yeah, and you know, for those of you listeners out there that may not know what an HBCU is, it's a historically black college and university. There are many of them. We actually have many of them in this area, not only UDC, but Howard and Bowie State. And where I went to University of Maryland College Park, but the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, we have many of them in the region. And, I'm proud to say that for the past 5 years, I've been a co-host of the Thurgood Marshall Annual Dinner, which raises money for HBCUs. And UDC is one of the oldest. I don't know if it is the oldest, but it's certainly one of the oldest. It goes back to 1853, I think.
Yeah, I think it's 1850. Right. I don't know if it's the oldest. I don't know that. But it was, D.C. Teachers College. But the impetus, I think, above all, to have it housed at the University of District of Columbia, because the University of District of Columbia is a land grant, it's an HBCU, but in this instance, what matters in terms of this mission, it's that it is the state university. It is the only public university, research university for the District of Columbia. And the mission will be to tell, as I say, the full story, the full arc of history from the role of Alexander Hamilton with Madison and Jefferson, that identified the general location of what this new capital should be, to the role of President George Washington, the surveyor, surveying the land that was not too far from Mount Vernon, understandably, and getting Maryland and Virginia to cede that land so that we could create this capital, the role of Pierre L'Enfant with the help of Benjamin Banneker and others, and to keep going in that story. And when did it take off? And, we'll have different individuals who can come forward and begin to tell that story. And so our hope is to begin with panels such as Bijan Bain is one of the ones who's going to celebrate the history of sports in Washington, D.C. And he's going to begin with a panel celebrating 1969, which was a banner year in sports for the city. And the reason was, we got Ted Williams to come and manage the Washington Senators, our baseball team, and Vince Lombardi to come and be the coach for the Redskins. So neither team had been quite, it was a surprising coup, let's put it that way. And the reason was that suddenly people began to say, I want to be in the Capitol. I want to be, in an environment where all of these political decisions are made, and with be able to rub shoulder with these power brokers. And so we began to create our own cachet, so to speak, and we're able to start attracting these celebrated personalities to the city.
Will you capture these panels for future viewing?
Well, that is our hope. We're working with University of District of Columbia TV, and we'll raise money to help them with that. But so far, they're going to record each and every one of our sessions. Indeed, we're planning to have a session coming up on the 26th of February around the whole incidents with the history around blackface and why that got to be such a point of a troubling point, shall we say, in the state of Virginia. And we're bringing in a curator, Dr. Dwandalyn Reese, who is just an exceptional professional from the African American Museum, the Smithsonian African American Museum. And we're going to, have some strong, individuals on that panel. And in every one of these panels, we're going to the University of District of Columbia Television will record it. And so it'll be available on podcasts and otherwise as because our role is to what? To make it accessible in terms of the conversation, but to illuminate the conversation. That's why we wanted the curator, not to just to have a conversation about what may be a point of pain or irritation in 2019, but why is it, what is that history? Why does this happen? Why are people insensitive? And then why are others hurt? Tell that story. And each time we want to sort of explain the origins of why, because these are problems that plague us today. What is the source of these problems? What are these points in our history? And it helps to illuminate the conversation debate of today.
That sounds absolutely fascinating and riveting and historic. And is there a way to simulcast it? Like, could we log on and get into their portal of the broadcast?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm sure we can figure that out. I'm glad you asked the question. We'd want that.
Yes, indeed, because I'm thinking, geez, can I get there on the 26th? And I thought, well, with technology today, we could probably view it live.
No, that would be great. So I can't answer the question from the point of view of my technical expertise, which is not much there, but I will certainly ask the question because we'd love for that to happen.
Wouldn't that be great? I mean, think about the audience that you could attract.
Well, this again has been a frustration for me. Number one, that we've seen so many statehood activists, like Dick Gregory, for example. Maria and I, we just put on an event for Dick Gregory on his birthday in coordination with his family. They ran a play at Arena Stage, and we threw a celebration. We sold tickets to 100 people, and we had a birthday party for Dick. He was such a strong supporter. And Maria is actually doing an independent study on him.
But you know what's so funny? I just finished it on Friday. I logged 182 hours. And when you mentioned, Mayor, his name, Dick Gregory, mm-hmm. I read his three autobiographies. I read a fourth biography. I've interviewed many, many people. And I am so in awe of the man. I there's no other person except for maybe Martin Sheen that did what he did for our world.
Well, he was a great guy. He was an exceptional guy. And he was an exceptional friend to any cause for justice. And to that end, and the great thing about him is that he put his energy and efforts where, in terms of, he didn't just say it. He did something about it. And he faithfully would show up every Thursday, almost every Thursday, and march with us. I mean, we didn't get a lot of press until the ultimate march to the Capitol where they arrested me and Dick and others. I think Dick Gregory got arrested that day, as did Jesse. but he was so, but without a lot of press, he would just faithfully show up. He was just wonderful.
And he's one of the more prominent people that we've lost in recent years. But there have been others that have were involved, and I could go through the list and you would know them all, Mayor, that we've lost over the years. So the idea of the Institute being able to, you know, take these people, do these interviews, keep them for posterity, I think is really great. And that's always been a frustration for me, is that we're losing these people and we're not documenting them and what they did. And in addition to that, another frustration is, look, you go to a cocktail party in Washington, D.C., and you meet the most amazing people sometimes. And you're like, why? How can we harness, you know, there's so many amazing people in this city who have done so many amazing things and have played an integral part in the history of America. And, you know, people that you haven't never even heard of. But, you know, when you sit down and talk to them and realize what they've done, it's amazing. And that's always been a frustration for me, too, is that, you know, to find a way to kind of harness their knowledge and their energy. And let's hope that the Institute becomes a focal point for people like this. That would be great.
Well, we hope to be a resource. And I think you're right. We have enormous talent, a city of people with exceptional gifts. And you're right. We need to harness those talents and resources to the advantage of realizing our own political dream of being full citizens in the United States of America. And I see a real focused, collaborative effort coming from the mayor and the council around statehood. I mean, in a way that, I mean, not that others haven't, you know, I know Vince also went to jail on these issues, you know, or got arrested on these issues.
Yeah, me too.
But there seems to be, and you too, Michael, I know, there seems to be a real resolve. Maybe it seems a more ripe and mature resolve to make it happen. And I'm very encouraged by that and, you know, want to do whatever I can to help, you know, and including facilitate getting some of that talent engaged to help us as also.
Well, and, you know, one of my favorite quotes from the Bible, Mayor, is Ecclesiastes, that to everything there's a purpose and there's a time and a season to every purpose under heaven. And that may be it, timing, you know. We invited as a guest a woman, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name right now, but who got arrested for not giving up her seat on a bus in Montgomery a couple of years before Rosa Parks did it. But Rosa Parks was there just the right time, right? And she was an activist, and she you know, this takes nothing away from, you know, her courage and everything she accomplished. But you got, you know, timing's an important part of the whole thing, right? You got to be there at exactly the right time. And by
yeah,
the way,
it is timing. I agree with you, Michael.
Well,
and let
you
me
know
just
what?
Well,
Michael,
what
do you
we're
remember
talking
the
about.
Young-
Well, I'm sorry.
I was
going
to say it's now the cause to me seems that it's multi-generational instead of a niche of your population. Because remember those young men we had on, Michael, that were and they were like 20 something and they were very passionate about D.C. for statehood. And when do the millennials get passionate about anything other than maybe Bernie Sanders? <you know?
laughs> But yes, they were. And you know, I think we're seeing more and of this in the District of Columbia. And, you know, this is an issue. Mayor Pratt is so right that people just don't know about it. Because when you go out and you talk to people throughout the country, which I've done, they're amazed. And they always side with you. I went to the Iowa caucuses and we put forth a resolution in support of DC statehood. And when they read the resolution, half the room was for it and half the room was against it. And they let me, they're kind people in Iowa, they let me speak to it for 5 minutes and we left with unanimous support for the resolution. It passed unanimously. When you explain it to people, they're shocked by it. They go, well, of course. And you know, it really is counterintuitive to think, as the mayor pointed out, that here you are in kind of the citadel of democracy and you don't have the same rights that everybody else has. People just assume you do. So again, the Institute could play a major role in getting the word out. And this is really what the show we do every week is about too, getting the word out. And it sounds like you're taking a very creative approach, Mayor. I think this idea to have somebody talk about, the origins of blackface. This is all that's been on the news I don't know about you in California, Maria, yes. But here in Washington, D.C., this has been the only thing that's been on the news for the last 4 or 5 days, and it's obvious that some people don't get it. Explaining it, I think, is an important thing. And it really does show the relevance of how our history relates to, the history of America and tells the American story. It really does in a lot of ways, because Washington was one of the first major cities in America. Charles Dickens wrote about Washington. He did a piece called he called us the City of Magnificent Intentions, and he wasn't a particularly kind description. So we have a great history in this
city. I think we were the first capital, I believe. I'm not that was created out of whole cloth like that. I mean, since then you've had Brasilia. Mm-hmm. Part of that was it was moved. They created a new capital in Brazil. But I they weren't, by and large, you think of it, London, it was a natural sort of choice to be the capital and so forth. But, originally we had been, with the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. President Washington was in oath of office administered New York, which was clearly two cities. Philadelphia at the time was the strong, much more sophisticated city than New York. But both meaningful cities where you had restaurants and hotels and so forth. And then here we are, not even anything out of whole cloth. It's such a fascinating story. But then again, America, in many ways, out of whole cloth with our hopes and aspirations as a nation. And so the fact that the city was, brand new, de novo, with the birth of the country. That we are such an interesting expression of both the hopes, the aspirations, as well as the issues that perennially have plagued our inability to achieve that more perfect union. And so our story is such an important story and such an American story. No one person can do it. You need to call upon the insights and the stories, the personal stories of our residents, so that we can create that, what it is, a kaleidoscope of hope, of experiences through the Institute. And we have, as you pointed out, Maria pointed out, we've got such interesting people here who can tell interesting stories that will give texture and definition to who we are. And people don't, again, know that we are our story and our diversity and our about the city. And so I think the Institute can play a role there.
Does
your home have enough real estate for you to expand as you see? Because everything you're saying is going to take up space.
Well, right now we're a very small operation of 2.5 people. We will, we'll have to raise money, and as we raise money, we'll identify space. But I don't think we will have to physically grow, other than we'll need people eventually to run programs for us. But I think that the notion around the resident fellows, the individuals who can tell the story of the Greek and Jewish theaters like Aviva, or can tell the story about sports like Bichon, or tell the story of ethnic cuisines like Susan Barocas. We'll rely upon them to organize events throughout a year. And so they'll put on a panel or a conference or a symposium around ethnic cuisines throughout the city. But they won't have to be you know, we'll have space that they can share, eventually space, shared space where they can share, that they can use. But otherwise, we just book rooms for them when they have an event, because that, you know, they can operate from home or their own office throughout the year. But our desire is for them to create activities that highlight that that facet of Washington life, whether it's a symposium or a conference, whether it may be with Rolem and Quanda, it may be an event at Mount Vernon, that, because there is a Quanda tour at Mount Vernon. And so it depends upon what, you know, their area, that facet as to where they might want to host an event. But we don't have to have all the fellows functioning in an office at the university.
And the archives, though, how will you house that?
Well, first it has to be transferred to the University of the District of Columbia. And I think that they've looked at a building where I think the city, that is the mayor and the council, have identified a building that they think they can rehabilitate for the purposes of the archives. And so that's going to be terrific, one, to have the building at a site that's easy and accessible to the District of Columbia, the public and the broader public. And then secondly, to have it right there at the university and, you know, with the Institute there will be terrific, because we want to work in partnership with the archivists there. And, you know, harness some of the data points from the archives, but also contribute to the archives, because much of the Quanda family story could then, there are products that can then be lodged at the archives. What Aviva does around Greek and Jewish theaters could then also be lodged at the archives. So we will hopefully enrich the D.C. archives as well. We would like to sort of involve a variety of historical organizations, you know, the D.C. Historical, the Martin Luther King Library, the Ladies Association of Mount Vernon, all of them, because what we have typically now is sort of a local archivist or historical organizations, and then we'll have the sort of the federal historical organizations. All of them should work as partners, we think, to tell that story. They don't, I mean, we're not forcing them to do it, but we hope they will do it, so that they can be, all become sort of strategic allies or historical partners with the D.C. Archives and the Institute of Politics, Policy, and History.
And, you know, well, first of all, let me say that the archives, it's great to hear about the archives, because they've been very hard to access in recent years, because they're in a little space in Martin Luther King Library, or at least last time I looked at them, that's where they were. So to liberate that stuff and get it where it's accessible would really be a great thing. And again, as the mayor says, our history in D.C. is so intertwined and so, we started a website called Teach Democracy, which interweaves the whole story of American democracy, hopefully, with the story of D.C. And there's such parallels, whether you're talking about Emancipation Day, which is our only official holiday here in the district, when Lincoln freed the slaves. They were first freed, which is a little ironic given our current situation. They were first freed here in Washington, D.C., or even as the mayor talked about, in sports. You know, the Washington Redskins were the last team in America to have an African-American football player, because they had the largest listening audience. There were no teams in the South. There were no Dallas Cowboys or Atlanta or Miami. And the owners of the team were afraid to antagonize white people in the South, so they wouldn't hire a black athlete until they built RFK Stadium. And the government said, you're not going into a government facility with an all-white team. And they hired a guy named Bobby Mitchell, who went on to be one of the greatest people that ever played for the team. So no matter what you're talking about here in the district, I agree with the mayor. It really, it has a great implication for and great lesson for America. In fact, that's what we call our website, Teach Democracies, Lessons for America. So
it does parallel, because when you think of it, the real debates of the country were played out here, because yes. everyone would come to the Capitol, and so you had a convergence of ideas, whether the political tensions and the cultural tensions inevitably get played out here. We're sort of the natural stage for all of that, yes, America's history, our history is a wonderful expression, for better or for worse, of American history. Yeah.
Well, and that's why we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves in today, right? Is because the founding fathers, they weren't sure how this whole idea of democracy and giving power to the people would work. So they didn't let women vote. They didn't let African Americans vote. They didn't let Native Americans vote. And they didn't want the people of Washington, D.C. to have any power, because they were afraid of what happened in Philadelphia when there was the riot over non-payment to soldiers from the Revolutionary War. So, yeah, it's really, really, if you study the history of Washington, you will see the history of America in so many different ways. And,
you're right. And and you think of it, I mean, it was what a leap of faith to create this mm-hmm. country. It was extraordinary. I mean, that the founding fathers won. I mean, they were up against the greatest navy yes. in the world. And they won, and they just wore them out, you know, and they just wore them out, and so they ultimately won. And almost no one thought, or even the people who were excited that they won the Revolutionary War, they were uncertain that this new experiment would last. And you're quite right. And so they were, I dare say, most of the only people who could vote, based upon a lot of it state law, were basically people of means, white males of means. So a poor white man in many states could not vote. So believed in, you know, democracy and a full expression, but not everyone was on board with that idea. But, you know, over the years, you think of it, those aspirations, and few countries have been established with such lofty aspirations as America. And over the years, those aspirations have guided us through a lot of struggle, a lot of tensions, an awful lot of blood lost in Civil War, et cetera. But we keep moving in the right direction. And, of course, certainly we've got those of us in the District of Columbia that we're not there, certainly until we are a part of it. But it's a fascinating, wonderful, and hopeful story of the history of Washington, the history of our nation.
I love the way that you, both of you, are positioning that, because it is hopeful. And that's why I keep thinking, Michael, you're getting close. It's like that little engine that could. And more to the point, not only is it aspirational, it's ambitious.
Yes, I agree. And do we have a caller? I think Doug said we had a caller. Do we have a caller?
Yes, you do.
Oh, okay.
Hi, welcome
caller,
to the program.
Thanks for calling in.
Hi, it's Bonnie.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Bonnie, do you have a question for the mayor?
I do have a question for the mayor. Hello, mayor. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, my pleasure's
gone. what I'm calling about, it's a little bit off point, but just recently I read something in the paper where they're thinking of changing the name of Woodrow Wilson High School because of his bringing Jim Crow into the District of Columbia and all of that. But the thing that has bothered me, that's happened in Virginia and several other places, is tearing down some of our history. Maybe it's not the best part of our history, but I think it's something that we have to remember. And so by tearing down statues of the Confederate war heroes, and that doesn't make sense to me, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, I think I have, mixed views. I mean, I think that the more one learns about Woodrow Wilson, the more troubled one is about a lot of his policies in this sphere. But, you know, a lot of people don't want to let go of what is now an established name of an institution that they, you know, I think the same thing happened at Ballou, where they said, okay, but we don't want people know I'm a graduate of Ballou, so I don't want to let go of that. So I think you've got to tell all the history. In fact, I think it's best to tell all the history. I think the key is let us not just celebrate the Confederates. Let us not just celebrate and allow Woodrow Wilson to get his story to be told without us pulling the covers off of his very, unkind policies, worse than unkind.
Exactly. I mean, I think I agree with that, too. Yeah. I just don't think that we can erase history.
You can't
Otherwise,
erase
there
history.
Wouldn't be the Colosseum in Rome.
And frankly, I think certainly what we are trying to do at the Institute is to make certain we sort of unearth all of that history, all of the good and the bad, you know, the ugly and the beautiful, all of it, because that's the only way we'll be really informed and be able to intelligently, or at least in an informed way, pursue new policies or just policies. So I don't think it serves our interest to just tear things down or erase history. I think it's better to, but you've got to balance it. You cannot just celebrate the ugly part of history and be insensitive.
Oh, God, no.
To
I mean,
it.
I don't think
and
that
I,
should
and,
be
and
celebrated
I don't think that's
at all.
What you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the question, Bonnie.
Thank
and
you
I agree.
Very much.
The thing that troubles me about it is where do we stop? You know, George Washington was a slave owner, Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, you know. Where do we stop? And I think the mayor makes a great point that you need to be balanced about it, that you need to tell
the story. And I think you've got to tell all the story. You can't just sort of blindly say, well, this is, you know, I'm
Pick
here,
and
this is, and ignore that the statute of this person that we all jump up and down about play a very unhealthy role in the history of our country. And I think that's part of what we're experiencing with people wanting to pull things down. And it's a reaction to how we have masked that the underbelly of our nation. The underbelly often has gone to the role of slavery and Jim Crow in American history. And it's not just Jim Crow and slavery. I mean, about the role, how we've treated women and others. But that is particularly ugly part of our history, painful part of our history, and it's one because it is so painful, because it plays
right.
such a pivotal role. We just have put so many covers on it, and there is sort of a growing impatience around that and a recognition that we can't continue to put covers, cover this up. We've got to talk about it. We've got to have that cathartic release. And we won't get there unless we have an honest conversation and pull the covers off of all of it. I think if people did that, you wouldn't have quite those same reactions. It's because we sort of look the other way on all of this. I think that's why people say, okay, well, I want no part of it, pull it down. I think you won't have that reaction to say pull it down if the full story is genuinely, authentically told, and I think we all know that story is not told.
Exactly. I agree
with that. Thanks, Bonnie. That was a great question. And we're running out of time here. So is there anything that you want to say, Mayor, that you haven't said about the Institute?
Is there a website?
No, it's everybody's Institute, and we're going to soon put up a donate sign. So on our website, and the website is www.ipph.org, ipph.org, and we welcome your input and, ideas, but also we're going to start encouraging $10, $25 donations to the Institute so that we can really thrive and grow with the support of the people of citizens of Washington, D.C., as well as, you know, what we do in terms of getting foundation money and the like.
And the technology, because that's, I think, instrumental, because what your messaging is going to get such a big, it's a bigger net that you're going to be able to. And the more that you get, it's like, you know, National Public Radio, the more people listen, well, the more there are people to donate.
Yeah.
Yes, good point.
Thank you for being on the show, Mayor. Well, when you announce your run, because according to my list, you're one of the few Democrats that hasn't announced that. But seriously, thank you so much. We wish you a happy birthday. Mayor Pratt just had a birthday last week. And thank you so much for being on the show. And we're going to leave you tonight, folks, with a song which we dedicate to the mayor. It's one of my favorites by Van Morrison. It's entitled "Once in a Blue Moon, Someone Like You Comes Along." Thank you so much, Mayor. And
thank
we hope
you,
to talk
Maria,
to you.
Maria, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to our listeners. We appreciate your loyalty.
Yes.
What's in a blue moon? Something good comes along. What's in a blue moon? Everything's not going Give the people their right to vote.